Welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, your conference co-host. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Kate Truitt, a clinical psychologist, applied neuroscientist, keynote speaker, and international best-selling author, renowned for her groundbreaking work in the fields of trauma, stress, and resilience. Dr. Truitt is the founder of the Truitt Institute, an innovative educational platform dedicated to advancing access to mental health support for all. She's the author of her just-released memoir, Keep Breathing, and the international bestseller, Healing in Your Hands. Dr. Kate Truitt, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited for this conversation.
So I'm really excited to have this conversation with you because I love brain science. And so I'd love it if you could start by helping us understand how brain science helps us understand anxiety better.
We all have a brain, and our brains do brainy things. And one of the things that I've learned throughout the course of my career, as well as my own personal journey with anxiety, is the better able I am to understand what's happening inside this noggin of ours, the better able I am to partner with my mind and my system to create empowered change and even lean into self-compassion. As anxiety is a full mind and body experience, but our brain plays a critical role in manifesting it as well as maintaining it as a key way to ultimately keep us alive, which is our brain's number one job. And a lot of people don't think about that when they think about anxiety, that there's actually an adaptive reason why it's there. And it's about the partnerships that we can give the anxiety a different job.
Absolutely. I related to so much of what you said. And it always reminds me of Dr. Ron Siegel. I can just imagine his face. He's got this little mustache and he says, our brains did not evolve to make us happy, Megan. And so, you know, I love talking about the brain and reminding people of that. And I think our, you know, I love self-help. Obviously, I've made a whole career out of it. And we've developed this sense that we are very empowered and that so much is in our control that we, I think, sometimes forget and lose track of how much is happening in the background that we aren't in direct control over, right?
Exactly. Well, and our brain loves to feel like we're in control because then it's being adaptive and helping us out. And our brain is terrible at uncertainty. There's a whole slew of literature out there that's fascinating that highlights that our brain really, really, really is bad at not knowing what's coming next. And in many critical ways, that's the core of anxiety. It's our brain trying to figure out the next steps in the gray ambiguity of the natural uncertainty that is our life.
Absolutely. The one thing that's guaranteed is that our life will be full of uncertainty, right?
Yes.
Unpredictability and change, despite all of our efforts. So in your books, you emphasize the role of the amygdala in anxiety, speaking of the brain. So can you explain what you call the three core values of the amygdala and how they contribute to the development and maintenance of anxiety?
Yeah. Well, and I'm going to pull back just a little bit. So in all of my work, I talk a lot about Amy the amygdala, personifying this brain part, because that does allow us to then start to reflect on how is this part of ourselves working for or against us? And a lot of the research that I started out doing many, many millennia ago was in rat labs because I had really severe debilitating social anxiety. Humans were terrifying to me, which is ironic now what I do for a living. But through that work in those rat labs and studying fear and learning and resilience, I started to see a core through line of three core values that then when I went to the literature really stand out. And there's really three things that our brain needs to help us stay alive. The first is pretty obvious, safety. We need to be safe. We need to know that there is not a tiger sitting in our room that's going to eat us. That's very important. A secondary piece that a lot of people don't think too deeply about because it feels like a given frequently is the idea of belonging and lovability. As humans, we are predisposed to depend on our caregivers. We have to. We're one of the weakest creatures when we're born. I was at my friend's house the other day, and she has a 5-day-old infant. And that little one would not survive in the wild. We need our people to survive. And so our amygdala, over the course of the 300 million years that it's been walking around this planet of ours, now that predates the dinosaurs. So our amygdala is really good at its job. It's been around a long time. for humans, it's developed this very deep realization that we need connection. And internally, our system develops a way of experiencing the world, such as, do I belong and am I lovable? And then finally, we need to know we can get our core needs met. I call this success. How do we have a roof over our house, shoes on our feet, food on the table, which of course, for that 5-day-old infant, circles back to lovability and belonging, and then fundamentally safety, because we don't feel safe, we don't eat, we don't sleep, and our entire system goes haywire. And all of that is at this very deep primal 300 million year old level in our brain.
And there's that old part of our brain, and you mentioned, you know, belonging, safety, core needs, and they're so connected, right? And this core part of our brain, when we think about belonging, like an infant, it's easy for us to imagine 5-day-old infant, like, won't survive without caretakers and belonging.
Yeah.
It gets harder when we get older. And like, I'm thinking about myself. And you know, if you're lucky in your adult life, you keep getting the opportunity to try new things that might make you a little bit uncomfortable, right? And sometimes those uncomfortable things make you feel like a baby that's been left in the forest when you're actually completely and totally safe. But when we think about those elements that you're talking about of belonging and core needs and safety, if we fail, even as adults, even if our life isn't in danger, it will feel like it. Our perception of our life is in danger because our livelihood might be in danger, or our social connections might be in danger, or things like that, right?
Yeah. Well, and that's how all of it plays out in anxiety, especially as we're developing across the course of our life. So we enter the world going, how do I stay safe? How do I belong, be lovable? And how do I get my core needs met? And then as we develop, we learn from our village, from our caregivers, from the experiences in the world, what it means to be okay within those core values. It's not adaptive though, Megan. It's not adaptive all the time. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's like, oh, if I do this, I get a cookie. And then I learn I like cookies, so I'm going to do more of that thing. But for many of us, life is way more complex than that. And to the idea of failure, we can learn that, hey, if I fail, if I'm not perfect, if I'm not XYZ, I will be kicked out of my village, which means death to that very, very primal brain. And so the anxiety starts to come in and play a continual role, an exhausting role for those of us who struggle with anxiety, in trying to say, don't do the thing that's going to get you kicked out. Don't do the thing that will make you unsafe. Don't do the thing that's going to take away your core needs. And our brain casts a very wide net. Generalized anxiety, that word generalized matters, because our brain, I call it a filter, starts to filter everything through this lens of threat, which then takes over everything. So our amygdala is one of the most powerful parts of our brain. It's great at keeping us alive. That's its top job. And so if it's nervous or wary or scared about something, you can bet it's guiding the way our brain is processing data all the time. It's exhausting. But loving, oddly enough.
You know, it's funny that you're talking about personifying the amygdala. And I knew a very, very, very famous rock star who I will not name because it's irrelevant. But what I'm going to talk about is his bodyguard. And his bodyguard, his name started with an A. So we'll call him Andy for the purposes of this conversation. And Andy was just hired because he was just this big, giant person, right? That made the rock star feel safe and made other people feel like it was unsafe to approach the rock star. And then when I got to know Andy better, he was like, I was like, well, you know, what are your, you know, dreams and aspirations one day? And he was like, you know what I really want to do? I really want to draw. And so it just reminds me so much of like the amygdala, like it wants another job. It doesn't necessarily want to be like on high alert and making everybody its enemy all the time, does it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the opportunity. And so much of the work that I specifically do is partnering with the brain. That's why I personify Amy going, hey, Amy, high five for keeping me alive. You've done a great job. And the tools you're using, the thought patterns that you're anchoring me into over and over again, they belong to old ways. What's the new opportunity? How does Amy want to draw? I talk a lot about sending Amy to the beach, and maybe she wants, you know, a virgin Mai Tai and just wants to hang out and watch the waves. What would that be like? And it's pretty foreign for people who are really living in the world of anxiety and that vigilance.
There's that constant chatter. I mean, I've battled it myself. Maybe you can relate to it too, right? Like, even at the very, very, very beginning, asking yourself, like, what do you want? What would make you happy? Is such a foreign concept to someone who's been living in like preventative danger land of like threat assessment land, and has called that home for so long. Is it, even the question itself can be scary, because then you, it's like you have this self-identity crisis of like, what if I don't have needs? What if I have no idea what would make me happy? What if I don't know what I want? It creates like a different sense of panic and a different source of panic.
Yeah, absolutely. And tied into that is even asking the question can shine the light on even greater uncertainty, which our brain doesn't like.
Absolutely.
And so there's a different opportunity where I start with a lot of my clients, and even in my own journey, is moving first into curiosity and openness, being in a state of inquiry. Going, what if? So, because we have the what if stories of doom, right? Like, what if all the bad things happen? Chicken Little and the sky is going to fall. And that's our amygdala trying to keep us safe. So we can give those what ifs a different job, because Amy's also involved in all of our positive emotional experiences. She's tied into our ability to feel loved and connected, to belong. Huh. What if we didn't have to be operating in the fear mode of I'm going to be kicked out of my village? And instead, we could get curious about, what if I did have people who supported me? Just what if? And it's like a gentle step into a possibility. And it's actually one of my training protocols and healing protocols that I teach. It's called the Creating Possibilities Protocol. It's just that really soft, curious question and turning those what ifs of doom on their head, because our brain's going to do it anyway. So let's give it a different job. Let's give it the gold star job rather than the I'm going to go hide in a bunker job.
Absolutely. I have a teenager, and so I've had to start shifting the way that I dole out wisdom, because he started to notice when I would get into that mode, and he was like, oh, here comes mom's therapy voice, and I'm not a therapist. Oh, here comes all the therapy. And so I was teaching them about the amygdala at one point, and anxiety, and it was saying, you know, anxiety is just imagination in need of like a career counselor. It just needs somebody to be like, great, you know, I see all your interests and what you're really great at, and we just need to give you a different direction, right?
Yeah, a different job.
And that's where I assume neuroplasticity comes into play, because we can take all of these advantageous things that our brains are capable of and just and redirect them and give them a different purpose, as I understand it.
Yeah, well, and a big talking point that I lean into in my books and in all the work that I do is that we have a very specific type of neuroplasticity called stress-induced structural plasticity that is informed by stress in order to keep us alive. And the hub of this very specific type of neuroplasticity is, of course, in the amygdala. And so our brain literally is building freeways to say, how do I keep you alive all the time? Which is great, right? Wouldn't you want Andy the bodyguard, if his job's to keep us alive, to be protecting us? Well, Amy's our internal Andy. And so when we look at the way we can give the amygdala a different job, having a new doorway to walk through that anchors in compassion first is critical. And that idea, I really highlight it so often. It's like, high five your amygdala first. Celebrate, and it sounds so counterintuitive, but celebrating the survival tactics, celebrating that stress-induced structural plasticity of how the brain learned to keep us alive, creates space for us to then give the neuroplasticity of a different way of being a job. It's opening up the door. Sometimes it may just be a tiny little crack in a window, sure, but it's opening up a different opportunity. And that's where the healing starts. But if we push against our anxiety, and I have struggled significantly with anxiety, if we push against it, it just gets stronger, because then we're lying to our amygdala. We can't lie to the part of our brain that is literally designed and has been very successful in keeping us alive our whole lives. We cannot lie to Amy. We have to partner with her.
Yeah, and I have so much compassion for people that, you know, because I've been through this as well, and I know you have, where you're trying to acknowledge all of the signals that you're getting, while your, you know, social systems, family systems have been telling you otherwise, right? Since you were a little kid, ways to ignore the sensations in your body, ways to ignore the instincts about the people around you, ways to ignore, you know, because it's more convenient or comfortable for them, or avoids discomfort for them. And not, I'm most of this is not malicious. Most of it's just around keeping the peace and trying to make everybody happy. But as an individual in our own bodies, that means that we've practiced a lot of disregarding those instincts and signals our whole lives. So it's more of a relearning process than many of us give us ourselves credit for, isn't it?
Yeah, beautifully stated. And I, in my memoir, Keep Breathing, I talk a lot about the narrative through line of my own family system and the complex impact that that had on me, using neuroscience as a sideline to walk through how my brain became so twisted and kind of gray within the complexities of always be fine, to your powerful point, Megan, be fine. Don't make waves. Don't create chaos. Don't feel what's happening in your mind-body system or acknowledge it, which even those two constructs, be fine and don't turn your intention inward, is going to generate ambiguity and uncertainty because we're telling our brain, don't pay attention to you, the thing that you literally are trying to keep alive. Don't know anything about it. I mean, if you had to go give a presentation on thermonuclear power right now, how would that feel?
That would give me anxiety, which would be the appropriate response to someone asking me to give that presentation. Yeah.
Right, me too. And that's what happens to so many of us. We grow up in a household where we're not taught to be curious about or invited into a space to learn about who we actually are. And so our brain creates a construct, but anytime we get a data point of authenticity, our brain freaks out because it's like, I don't know what to do with that. I don't know what to do. It's scary, it's overwhelming. And then the anxiety generalizes because the brain just doesn't know what to do. The
Yeah.
exciting thing is we can unwind it and we can take our brain back with intention and help our system heal.
And I know that you've got this seems like a good point to, or a good turning point to talk about kind of what those techniques are and how we start that process, you know, specifically.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of wonderful therapeutic tools out there. And I mean, you're a coach yourself, so I'm sure you use a whole bunch of them for your own healing. And there's a newer modality that I'm a co-developer of called the Havening Techniques, which evolved out of something called EMDR, which is eye movement. And yeah, wow, my brain just gave up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good to just
See,
acknowledge it, right?
brainy moments, right? Brain moments. And then tapping, thought field therapy or emotion focused therapy, where you're using different psychosensory interventions to create electrochemical change. So Havening partners with gentle, soothing touch to shift the way our brain is processing information in the moment. And we're as humans wired for touch. If an infant doesn't receive touch, they will not develop in a successful manner. We have a lot of literature around that. It's critical for a healthy mind-body system. We can use touch at any stage across a lifespan now to repartner with our brains, to amp up the impact and the positive experiences of neuroplasticity. So it's almost as though our brain has its own healing mechanisms built in, which makes sense because if you get a paper cut, your skin has the ability to heal itself. One would think that evolution would build in something similar for our own brain. And in fact, it did. And the founders of the Havening Techniques, Doctors Ron and Steven Rudin, really dug deep at 10-year investigation into trying to understand how EMDR and tapping work. And in their process, accidentally created this thing called Havening. And they're so sweet about it. They're like, we did this thing and it works and it's amazing. And now it's a global experience. And it works. It's pretty profound because we can take the power of healing into our own hands, which is the name of my first book, which is Healing in Your Hands, empowering ourselves to do our own healing journey at a deep neuroplastic level.
And so what might how does this work as far as, because I know there's, you know, tapping, you can kind of get an intro to it when you can YouTube and find a bunch of things on that. EMDR is more something somebody helps you through. It's a technique that you do in partnership with a facilitator. So with Havening, how does that work and what might somebody expect from a session of that?
Yeah. Well, what one things I love so much about Havening is that there's two different pillars for it. One is more along the lines of the EMDR clinical practitioner experience, where you're working with the facilitator, they are guiding the work. That is the way to go, especially if you're working on really intensive, deep trauma. And a huge part of why I'm a developer now with Havening is through the self-Havening courses and programs that I've developed, which is our own healing program, which is a little bit more along the lines of tapping. And it's interesting because I never studied tapping until this past year or two, and I got to become good friends with Robin Bellazarian, who's an amazing tapping trainer. And when she came to a couple of my trainings, she's like, "Oh, wow, this is the tapping." And I was like, "It is?" And at the end of the day, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of giants, and it's integrating the psychosensory tools, cognitive paradigms to create shifts. So the Healing in Your Hands programs, my vision with that, and it's unfolding, is how do we safely, in a trauma-informed manner, help people partner with their brains, partner with their little friend Amy, the amygdala, without running the risk of re-traumatizing themselves, because that matters, of course. And creating a new neurobiological through line. And one of our key terms in my clinic and in my training programs is we're healing the past, creating the present, and building the future. It's like a V or a U-turn of healing. We go down the activation, create the present, and then build towards resilience and empowerment through intention, which is what my first book is all about. But to the point of going on YouTube, I have a YouTube channel where you can go learn how to do your own healing program and walk alongside me through the YouTube channel to do your own work. Because frankly, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, Megan, but mental health is a human right and therapy is a privilege. So it's beholden on me as a psychologist and a neuroscientist to translate what is unattainable and make it safely accessible to the world at a global level. Because healthier humans are happier humans.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And one of the things that I always want to make sure that I say at this point, and please, if you disagree with me, feel free to do so. This is not a statement of fact, but one of the things that I wish somebody had told me at the beginning of my anxiety and trauma journey was that I did not have to divulge, share, re-experience the worst things, the
Yes.
most vulnerable things, or the worst things I had done in my life in order to heal any of that. And these kinds of techniques, EMDR, Havening, EFT tapping, ART therapy, are all techniques that don't require you to do that. Am I correct with Havening?
Yes, yeah. And case in point, so we are right down the street from NASA JPL. There's a lot of non-disclosures that go on in those spaces. We work a lot with the FBI, the CIA. We've done trainings with the Department of Defense. You want to guess who's not allowed to divulge anything? These are the people. So we work completely content-free. And additionally, to that point of not having to disclose, as somebody who experienced a deep re-traumatization in therapy, and that's one of the first, I think it's like the chapter five of my memoir, I talk about this experience. It's been really interesting since the book came out. So how many therapists in the world have reached out to me and said, "Thank you for sharing that story," because we don't have to open up Pandora's box to create really powerful and incredible change. And opening it up, especially if we're not trauma-informed, if we don't know how to do trauma work, can be, and I know this firsthand, extremely dangerous. Extremely, extremely dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the more that we learn and the more of these modalities that we talk about and the more that people come out with free, accessible ways to teach and for people to learn, The more that we'll have access to that, because you're absolutely right. It can be very dangerous. And I think people's safety, and not necessarily like full and complete absence of discomfort, right? That's not what we're talking about. But when we're talking about trauma and severe anxiety, it can be incredibly dysregulating in an incredibly damaging long-term way if you're not just carefully treading.
Yeah, well, because our brain's trying to keep us alive and safe. And anxiety will cast that wide net and tag a stimulus as unsafe or dangerous, and then expand that at an exponential level. So, what happens if we're sitting with a healing practitioner and we become re-traumatized, or our symptoms become magnified in that session? But more so to the free resources, and this is something that I do a lot of work around, identifying solid individuals who are providing really good care, because there's individuals out there who are saying they're providing healing resources, but there's no empirical validity to the work that they're doing. Furthermore, they're operating outside their scope of practice and teaching tools that are not trauma-informed. And so when we're watching a video and guided to do something, that our system then becomes activated into a state of severe anxiety or panic, dissociation, or trauma, our brain and our body system relearn what might have been taught in childhood. Don't pay attention to your data in here. Don't trust yourself. And that's one of the deepest violations, is when we're taught we cannot trust ourselves.
Absolutely. And what you were talking about earlier, too, back to the beginning of this idea of self-compassion and agency, those are, two of the things that have a lot of times been taken away from us. We didn't have the choices available to us, especially as kids, to retain our sovereignty, to retain our agency, to retain our choice, and our boundaries. And so when we get into a situation, I'm just going to try to emphasize why this is so important. When we get into situations as adults, when we're with practitioners who aren't operating in our best interest, again, I'm not assuming any malicious intent, but if they're
Yeah, of
operating
course.
in a way that's not in our best interest, we don't blame them. We blame
We
ourselves,
blame ourselves. Yes. Yes.
right? We
Yeah,
will do the
exactly.
mental gymnastics and emotional gymnastics to say that once again, I'm the problem or I'm wrong, or and so much of that goes back to shame, which I know we haven't even talked about yet, but
And the core
that's
value of how we've been taught to stay alive. And this is the sweet kind of, I hesitate to use the word crazy, but I know in my own trauma and anxiety moments, my brain feels crazy making. This is that counterintuitive nature of our brain, where if we can blame ourselves, we are putting control back into the situation, because then our brain's like, ha ha, I can now be more vigilant around that and have even more anxiety about that happening again in the future, which is control, ironically, but not really, as we know.
Absolutely. Yeah. I always say that control is the counterfeit currency of safety when it comes to people with
Oh, I
anxiety.
love that. Oh, I
We're
love
just
that.
like
What a great
dealing. We're like on the
line.
Vegas floor, just dealing out control. Just like, I got this. Everything's fine.
I'm never
Oh,
leaving my corner again.
exactly. Oh, well, the wonderful and positive and amazing news is that there are so many techniques and practices and intelligent, completely awesome people like you that are teaching these tools in the world and that are available to people without having to put themselves in any more danger or disclose things to people that they're not ready to. And I hope for people's sake that they do eventually get to a place of safety, security, self-compassion where they can, have somebody in their lives that can acknowledge and validate their experiences and hold them for them. But until then, I think these things are awesome. So thank you for your work.
Yeah, and right back at you. Thank you for your work. And I think one of my big dreams ultimately is that we have that internal agency. That's one of my favorite words, to say, wait a minute, I can hold this for myself. And there are experiences that take a lot of reparenting, a lot of self-compassion, a lot of giving ourselves the what should have been but wasn't. And because of neuroplasticity, it's all powerful. And our brain is constantly changing. So we can harness that to go back and help our brain find a new way forward. And what an incredible gift that neuroscience has given us. And havening is another opportunity to go on that path. There's many modalities And my favorite is to integrate them. Find what works for each of us as we partner with our brain and body to build the future we want to be living in.
Absolutely. Kate, how can people find out more about you and your work in Havening?
Yes. So of course, I have the books we mentioned. So my memoir, Keep Breathing, and then an entire healing program is in the Healing in Your Hands book, which you can see Healing in Your Hands right there. Keep Breathing right there. You can find those on Amazon, and they're globally available on Kindle. And well, hardback, you can obviously order a copy of them anywhere, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, wherever you enjoy buying books. My YouTube channel, TikTok, Instagram, they're all very different in terms of the content they provide. And so depending on what individuals choose for their content and what feels comfortable with them, you get all sorts of great information, guided healing tools, practices on all of those. I'm a big shareware person. If you go to drkatetruitt.com, you can download free resources and guides for how to do your own work. I have a clinic in Los Angeles, where I'm based, California based, and would like to do some deeper work with my team, a training institute, truittinstitute.com. And then at a global level, we have havening.org, where people can find practitioners all over the world who have many, many different areas of expertise and practice. And so I highly recommend looking there if you're not in California or you're looking for a very specific type of practitioner to walk alongside. We have many amazing humans who are doing this really powerful work.
Fantastic. Dr. Kate Truitt, thank you so much for being with us today.